The boogeyman is real, and you found him.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I'm your number one fan.
I like to dissect girls. Did you know I'm utterly insane?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
7 days.
I am Dracula.
We have such sights to show you, boy.
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
I am the eater of wounds and of children.
What's in the fucking box?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
One by one, we will take you.
Never get out of bed again!
You gotta be fucking kidding.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
Welcome to prime time, bitch! Ha 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 ha!
Welcome, horror fans. It is Wednesday, 7 p.m. Central Time. That means it's time for another episode of the Week in Horror Podcast, the only podcast available on both sides of the veil. And if you, dear horror fanatic, are listening to us at the top of the week, remember we do this live right here on YouTube every preceding Wednesday. So we hope to see you in the live chat. Come and join us. Hang out with us, you know, freaks and ghouls. This week, we are looking back at select horror films released March 31st through April 6th. Thank you all so much for joining us for what will surely be a bloody good time. I am JL, and I will be holding down the fort tonight as my co-hosts are currently engaged in some pretty busy stuff. So I know that Eugene and Johnny are currently on set. Aaron is working on his set, and I know that Alex is either with the kids or something's going on there. It's just like the man is so busy, you know, there's no telling where he's at. Probably driving somewhere is where he's probably is. So, but I hope all of you are doing well tonight. Let's see. We've got a bunch of people in the chat. But before we dive into anything, let's make sure that we get up that Patreon banner. There they are, all the amazing people who helped to make this show possible. We appreciate every single one of you. We couldn't do any of this without you. So if you'd like to, you know, if you're interested or you're curious, check out our Patreon link. It's down in the description. You can support the channel and help us keep the show, you know, doing what we do. And of course, all the cool stuff we have going on in the background, all the production stuff we have going on, the film stuff we have going on. So, and your name gets attached to all of that. So we thank you all for that support. We couldn't do it without you. All right. Who do we have in the live chat tonight? Because we have, I see some regular names in there. I do, before we dive into some very interesting stuff tonight, very cool stuff that we have to talk about. So I think some films that we're going to go kind of deep on, I really do. I think they deserve some real, well, three of them deserve some real discussion. You know, one of them doesn't, but that's the nature of Week in Horror. You know, we don't always get bangers and for every single selection every week, because, you know, not every week has, you know, banging movies that come out. But we have three very solid ones I think we're going to get really deep on. But let's see. We've got Casey Cooper in the chat. Good to see you, Casey. It says, well met. Thanks so much for being here tonight. Sherry Tilly as well. Good to see you, Sherry. Glad you're here. Casey said, I had a 2-hour and 40-minute talk with my developmental editor last week, and I'm excited about how the publishing path is going. Congratulations, bud. I cannot wait. To read the final product. So congrats on that. Travis Brown's hanging out, says, evening everyone, and hope you do not pick up a certain alien egg in your Easter basket. Yes, the colored one with the flaps on top, not a good one to get. I think there was a web comic that had that. I can't remember. Saturday morning breakfast cereal, was it that? No, I can't remember what it is. No, I can't remember. There was some web comic that had that. It was like, yeah, it was just four panels, and it was, I think it was, yeah, and then the alien egg came out, and you're like, but I remember that, so that was always funny. Or I think it was that it was the alien one, and then like the bunny. Yes, it was like an alien dress. It was like a xenomorph dressed up as the Easter bunny, and it was like, you know, running through, and it had like a basket full of, you know, facehugger eggs that it was putting everywhere. Oh, let me see. Rodan L.S. name is here. Good to see you, Rodan. Says Frankenstein was a self-made man. Yes, he was. Oh, yeah, and then of course I will have to say, Casey Cooper says, well, I think he had a wee bit of help, just a little bit. You know, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. But good to see you. Aaron Reese is hanging out in the chat. Good to see you, Aaron. Says, hola. Thanks so much for hanging out. Roden Ola's name says, without Johnny O, is it weak in horror? Sometimes, but not always, but sometimes it is. Sometimes it is, Roden. Left-handed Jedi, good to see you. says, what will be the price for drama tonight? Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, so please smash those like buttons. Jefferson Spatchcock is here. Good to see you, bud. Says, howdy, horror harlots. Good to see you, Jefferson. Thanks so much for hanging out. Jinju as well. Says, I've been going through them all afternoon, but the entrails say that the TP-9000 will be running today. Only, I don't think so. I don't. Only on one of them could the... No, I don't even think on one of them the TP-9000 will be coming up, because there's stuff to talk about on three of these films. One of them, I know you already know which one it is. So, let's see. Aaron Reese says, I've spent the past few days repairing and painting furniture that I spent the previous week and a half building. Very nice. I can't wait to see the final set when you're done. I think it's... I've seen some pictures of your progress. I think it's going to be good. So, you know, I can't wait to see the final product. And when it's all done and set up, you got it all lit and everything, I think it's going to be fantastic. So let me see. Ovomorphs. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's see. I think Rodenell's name just sent me that picture. Oh, that's yes. Go find the eggs. It's an alien in Easter Bunny costume. Fantastic. Oh, I love it. All right. Let me see. Too bad someone has to be prepared. Oh, yeah. Well, I think he had to. Yeah, probably. He's got four kids. So, yeah, it usually entails that things have to be repaired constantly. At least I've heard. That's what I've heard. I don't have kids myself. So, you know, I have way too many expensive things, you know, or I would say, yeah, some of them are expensive. Some of them are just like, you know, personally, you know, like very important to me. So I don't, you know, I wouldn't know. So I wouldn't want to risk it. All right. Let's see. Well, as people are coming in, I will try and say hi as I see you pop into the chat. But we have some stuff to talk about tonight. First and foremost, it was recently announced, and this has me... Okay, so this is interesting stuff. As far as news goes, so I love the Chucky franchise. I do. I especially love the fact that I love for two big giant reasons. One, hey, Omni Orosboros is here. Good to see you. This is Hi Jail. Thanks so much for hanging out, Omni. Appreciate you hanging out. So I love the first two films. Number two is arguably better than number one. I'll say is a marked improvement over number one. I mean, it was amazing. Three kind of hit a, you know, was kind of a, you know, kind of plateaued, because I mean, where do you go after two? You know, so it's telling the exact same story over and over again. And then they slid into satire really fast with Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky, and then moved back into straight horror with Curse and Cult. So I like how Mancini has handled the franchise. I do. And then you have the Sci-Fi Series channel, which the Sci-Fi Series, the Sci-Fi Series over on the Sci-Fi, the channel, blah, 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 I can't talk. The series over on the Sci-Fi channel, which I believe is now completed two seasons, which has pretty much followed the tone of Cursed Cult and is, you know, narratively connected. So it's, you know, you're going all the way. And then you have, it was recently announced that Don Mancini is in the early stages of working on a new Chucky movie. Now, how that ties into, because they've managed to maintain, oh, and the second reason why I love it is because Fiona Dourif has joined the franchise in the footsteps of her father, Brad, who originated the voice of Charles Lee Ray. So, you know, Brad Dourif is, you know, phenomenal work. He's a horror legend. And then, of course, we've got Fiona in there, which rocks as well. But then you've got Don Mancini, who has maintained the structure of this franchise for, you know, the entire run. And so now with Chucky season three, with the second half of season three coming out on April 10th. So the first half, it ended. So the first half of season three ended with Chucky apparently dying of old age in the doll body. And because literally like his Loa god, Dumbala, has cut him off. And so he came because he participated in a Catholic exorcism. And so he's cut off from his god. And so he can no longer jump bodies. He can no longer partition out his soul, and he can't escape. And now he is dying of old age in that body, that in the doll body that he's in. And so the question is, what will happen to him? We'll find that out in part two of season three, which comes out April 10th of this year, which when that will debut. But we know that Don Mancini is in the early stages of working on a brand new Chucky movie. So bringing that back for another, bringing the character back for another film, I don't know where that's going to go. So that could be interesting. So I'm excited about that you know, Don Mancini is returning to the big screen, and hopefully it will not be, hopefully it won't be like another silly satire one. Hopefully it'll be like in the straight horror vein, like Curse and Cult and the first two films and what the third tried to be. So I'm really looking forward to that. Should be very, very interesting. Let me see. Dib Dib is here. Good to see you, Dib Dib. Thanks so much for being here. Aaron Reese says, I refuse to let Jefferson Spatchcock get his face on stream before I'm back. It's a principal thing. It's a challenge. That's a challenge to you, Jefferson. Absolutely is. Oh, let me see. Aaron Reese asks, anyone ever wondered if Charles Lee Ray's body is just in the grave spouting My Buddy recorded lines? That's hilarious because they swapped. That's funny. That'd be funny. All right. And what was the other thing I missed? I missed something else. Was it? Maybe it wasn't important. I don't think it was important. Yeah, it probably wasn't important. I know that there's a new Easter horror film coming out, Easter Bloody Easter, which will, I mean, honestly, to be perfectly honest, Critters 2 has always been kind of like the essential Easter film for me, for as far as like Easter horror goes. There've been other like holiday themed anthology films that have touched on Easter. I think that the film Holidays, when it had like the anthropomorphic rabbit Christ figure that spit eggs out of the holes in its hands that hatched into baby chicks, that, you know, as blasphemous as wonderfully blasphemous as that was, I think that was a good attempt. But Critters 2 has always been kind of like the go-to as far as like Easter horror goes. But there's a new one coming out, Easter Bloody Easter, which is now available via streaming. So if I remember correctly, where is that available on? Is that on Bloody Disgusting? Is that on Screambox? I think so. I have to double check. Is that on Screambox? I think so. Yeah. Available via VOD. Available via VOD. So yeah, definitely check that out. Easter Bloody Easter. It's about an Easter bunny gone mad and is killing everyone. So could be entertaining. I haven't seen it yet, but looks intriguing. So yeah, like that. So as far as Easter horror movies go, if you're looking for a new one, that's one right there. All right. And this is really, really cool. And I'm glad we got a chance to show it because this trailer recently dropped. I have a new trailer to show everyone. So if you have not seen this one yet, I'm glad to get this opportunity to show it to you. Hi, Angel Rivera. Good to see you. It says, what up, horror fiends? Thanks so much for hanging out, Angel. Appreciate you being here. And Joshua Lee, good to see you. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Joshua Lee. Appreciate you being here. All right. So there is a new horror film coming out, which I am excited about because it's written and directed by Chris Nash. And Chris Nash, while you may not have heard that name, has been a longtime special effects artist. He was worked on a number of films that we all know and love. Predominantly, you'll recognize his work in The Void. And I think there was something else. He directed the short Z for Zygote in ABCs of Death 2. So, and in that one, that's the one where the woman is pregnant, but her husband's gone. And then she decides not to give birth. And then the baby like grows and grows and grows. And eventually like gets so large that it eventually just like kills her and pushes out all her organs, takes over her body and starts walking around in her skin, you know? And then the husband comes home. And then it's like, yeah, so she's not pregnant anymore. And then he's like, it's okay, we'll try again. And the cycle continues. It's really, really creepy. So really, really graphic and gross. So Chris Nash, who worked special effects on ABCs of Death, worked special effects on The Void, and was the director of the segment Z is for Zygote on ABCs of Death 2, has his first major feature film coming out called In a Violent Nature, which is a fascinating looking horror film. But we have the trailer and I'm going to show it to you. So let's cue up the terror tube. So that was the trailer for In a Violent Nature, the upcoming ambient horror slasher from Chris Nash, written and directed by Chris Nash. And essentially methodically depicts the enigmatic resurrection, rampage, and retribution of an undead monster in the remote wilderness. And so it's essentially a slasher film from the unique perspective of the killer themselves. This is why the camera is following behind them. So it's from their perspective, from the mute killer. So really, really fascinating. And it's being hailed as kind of like a revolution of the slasher, kind of a new original take on the slasher genre, as it is not what you would expect in the fact that it relies more on its ambiance and its atmosphere in order to generate the tension and the thrills as the slasher is, you know, going through the woods on it, on the, you know, on their rampage. So starring Rye Barrett, Andrea Pavlovic, Cameron Love, Reese Presley, Liam Leone, and Charlotte Cregan. The film is set to release, I believe, May 31st of this year. So May 31st, 2024, right before the summer hits. It's a couple days before my birthday. So I'm excited about that. But yeah, I'm definitely going to check this one out. That one's called In a Violent Nature, which looks really, really interesting. Jefferson Spatchcock says, so Michael Mann's Friday the 13th. Very, I like that. I like that very much. that's cool. But yeah, I'm really curious. Chris, I've known of Chris Nash for years now, and as a special effects technician, he's worked on a bunch of stuff, and I knew him from ABCs of Death 2. He also directed a music video for The Birthday Massacre, which is one of my favorite Canadian bands, Canadian alt rock bands. If anybody's familiar with them, definitely check out their music, because you know it's really, really good shit. But he directed their music video for their single One. And I've always been a fan of them. You came across that, seen his work in horror films, and now he's got his first feature-length film coming out, which is really, really badass. He's done a number of shorts, so you know I think it's gonna be really, really good. Omni Orosboro says, when are we getting JL as a mutant demented Santa? Well, unfortunately, I've got the beard, but I don't know if I have the size anymore. You know? I don't. I used to. But I don't think I have the size anymore for Santa. Or I would need padding. I think I'd need padding. You know, I need to like really, you know, with to get like the moobs and the gut and everything. But yeah, I've got the beard. You know, the beard is slowly reaching, I think, wizard levels. So I'm quite pleased with it, you know? Or maybe like, you know, like austere critic, you know, austere film critic. I don't know. This should be interesting. So that is May 31st, 2024, In a Violent Nature will be releasing. And I don't know if that'll go directly to, it's going to be just in theaters, but if it's on streaming, I'll definitely check it there, but I'll have to take a ride down to the nearest movie theater, which is like an hour away from me, in order to check that out. So I'm looking forward to that. That looks really, really creepy. So 2024, looking to be a good, strong year for horror. Got some good films coming out and some ones that are really, really challenging the status quo. We're seeing more innovation and originality and more attempts at originality in the horror genre these days than we are in any other genre. I've noticed that in whether it's adventure or fantasy or action or romance or comedy, it's just recently, it's been the same tropes over and over and over and over again. And the only genre I've seen some legitimate attempts at trying to do something new, do something interesting, kind of capture the audience, you know, tell a story of directors willing to try and make it their own. I'm only seeing that in the horror genre and the subgenres, you know, whether it's slasher or whether it's horror sci-fi or whether it's whether it's undead or, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm seeing good attempts this year. 2023 and 2024 I think 2024 is going to be a good year. We got some good stuff coming out. While I'm still on the fence for films like, you know, The First Omen, or fucking, you know, like The Strangers Chapter One, but we've got movies like, you know, Late Night with the Devil. Late Night with the Devil looks phenomenal. I haven't had a chance to catch it yet. Immaculate with the Hollywood's new go-to girl, Sydney Sweeney. Looks amazing as well. That one's getting like rave reviews. So looking forward to that. So this is shaping up to be a really solid year. Really solid. As a matter of fact, I haven't seen Immaculate yet and I can't wait to see it. But from what I've heard, all of the like crazy fundies out there are like up in arms about this film being like, you know, it's like a pro abortion thing. Like, you know, like the woke female. It's crazy how much people are who don't like horror films, how much they're up in arms. When a film generates that much controversy, that's a movie you have to go see, because you got to see at least what it's saying. You know, as long as the film evokes something in you, you know, that's the important thing. Whether it, you know, it brings something up, which is why I love Ari Aster's stuff so much, like Hereditary, and I like Robert Eggers' stuff, you know, like The Lighthouse. So shit that generates something in me. Which is such a bummer, because The Norseman, you know, was good, and it's Robert Eggers' work, but it was good, but it didn't conjure. So it wasn't like, you know, Midsummer, or it wasn't like, you know, The Lighthouse, where that visceral feeling that you get, where it really taps into your personal spaces. So I don't know, but I think 2024 is going to be a good year. Let's see. Make sure Tang Whistle is here. Tang Whistle CPM says, aha, access to the live chat finally popped up my phone. Good to go, Tang. Thanks so much for being here tonight. We appreciate it. People are talking about making me a big fat Santa. That's hilarious. Aaron Reese said, I tried The Strangers, but couldn't get my zipper undone with both hands numb. One stranger. I call it a stranger. Yes, I remember that from Chappelle's show. Yes. Case Cooper says, if the evangelicals are up in arms, they must be doing something right. Damn straight. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. So I can't wait to check that one out. All right. Well, as our good host Alex likes to say, we have some horror movies to dive into, and we've got some good ones tonight. Well, good in my opinion. We have some things to talk about. I do wish the other guys were able to be here. They're busy right now. When it opens up and you're working as a free, when you're pretty much, it's a gig economy. When you're working gig to gig, you got to take what you can get. So they're currently on set right now. I think they're working on the same project as we speak. So, but you know, they're getting paid. So that's an important thing. So that's why I'm here and I can hold it down and I think we can dive into the stuff, but be forewarned, rants may be incoming. All right, let's dive into it. The very first film that we got to talk about tonight, released April 2nd, 1980, and it's Inferno. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. All right, that was the trailer for Inferno. Amazing film. So, directed and written by Dario Argento, based on Suspiria de Profundis by Thomas De Quincey, as were the first film and the third film in that trilogy, and starring Eleonora Giorgi, Gabriella Lavia, Veronica Lazar, Leopoldo Mastelloni, Irene Miracle, and Daria Nicolodi. Daria Nicolodi, who was at the time, was married to Dario Argento. This particular film, the second film in his trilogy, the film follows essentially the brother of, it leads off with what seems to be the protagonist, Rose, as she is uncovering the story of the three mothers, who are the three witches that pretty much rule the world through darkness and misdeeds and you know, destruction from around the world. One of which lives in Freiburg, one lives in Rome, and one lives in New York. In the course of her investigation, Rose ends up disappearing. She sends a letter to her brother before her disappearance, leading her brother to come to Rome to try, or leading her brother to come to leave Rome and go to New York to try and find her. Or was it, to come to New York, try to find her, where he uncovers what's going on in the building that she's living, because Rose suspects that the building she lives in is actually housing one of the three mothers, which it is. And so through all kinds of crazy, like witchcraft and, you know, monsters running around, eventually, her brother battles the forces of darkness and uncovers the entire plot. So there's a fascinating aspect to this particular film. One thing that people will notice is, like, if you watched Suspiria, and then in 2007, if you watched it, I believe it was in 2007 when the third film came out, which I believe was Mother of Tears. Yeah, 2000 was the Mother of Tears, which is supposed to, like, it was delayed for a long time. You'll notice that there are two major differences, or one giant major difference, between the first and the third and the second one. And that is tonally, and is that the tone and the narrative of each one. Suspiria and the Mother of Tears rely very, very heavily on Argento's surrealistic vision, or his surrealistic cinematography, and how he tells a story through imagery instead of through exposition, which is really, really important. That's how Suspiria drove itself, where if the audience is not watching what's happening, if they're only listening, they're only getting half the story. So with Dario Argento's work, you have to be paying attention, because everything in his work speaks to what is going on in the narrative, where they are, what architecture is being put on screen, what colors are being present, predominantly the hues of blue and red, and how they interchange and how they cross-sect across the screen. All of these are very, very important. So the the difference between the first and the second one, I know Aaron Reese is talking about refused to watch third because of Asia Argento. We're going to dive into that. I promise with the next film, I promise. So there's stuff to talk about there. It's very fascinating stuff with Dario Argento, with Nicolodi, with Dario Nicolodi and Asia. So interesting backstory there. But in this particular film, there's a major tonal and narrative difference. And that is because during the shooting of Inferno, Argento got sick. And I believe it was he was suffering the symptoms of hepatitis. And so he contracted hepatitis and he got sick numerous times throughout the production. He had to direct it he was in so much pain. He had to direct the film from lying flat on his back. But there was a point in time where he had to be hospitalized. He was in so much pain. And the guy he brought in, and it was just really, really smart of him, because this is what I love about Italian horror. Italian horror, there is more inclination for everybody to work together because it's not the competitive, you know, beast that it is here in America, where everybody's trying to one-up everybody, where everybody's just trying to outbeat everybody else, trying to make that money. In Italian cinema, it's very much everyone drives. The rising tide lifts all boats. So Dario, to shoot this film, brought on his mentor, Mario Bava, to come in and assist him with like optical effects, mats, and a number of other, and basically kind of like run units, to run like the secondary unit in case Dario was there. It's like, you know, come in, you just basically just, you know, lend the hand that I know you are. And, you know, Bava was his mentor. So he brings Bava in to kind of assist on the back end and just pick up the little thing and utilize his talents. Unfortunately, Dario got really sick and Bava had to take over. Now, that's not to say that Mario Bava is not a phenomenal director. He's a legendary director in his own right. But he and Dario have incredibly different styles, which is why I think that Inferno is actually, of the three, while I love Suspiria, I really do, and I love how it's a testament to Mario's original vision before his decline in later years, because there was definitely a drop-off in the quality of his films, because the same reason you've seen a drop-off in the quality of John Carpenter's films. While I love Carpenter, giant Carpenter fan, celebrate his filmography all day long. Even movies like Ghosts of Mars have their little shining points, but there's definitely a drop-off in quality. Whether it's access to funds or it's access to actors or whatever it might be, you know, what's currently going on in the industry or what's going on in the public eye or what's popular doesn't tend to lend itself all the time to a particular director. The director can't really, can't really bob and weave with the times. If you're pretty much stuck in that one genre, that's what you're going to do, it's going to be tough. There's going to be lean years where the world is just not eating up what you're putting out. So in that sense, we're seeing kind of a resurgence. John Carpenter is kind of coming back. You know, we're feeling again because we're seeing a big uptick in, you know, the quality of horror films. They're getting more money. They're getting more attention. They're getting more respect thanks to the likes of individuals like, you know, Fede Alvarez and Ari Aster and Robert Eggers and a number of other, you know, up and coming directors. So really, really smart stuff out there. Now, because Bava took this over, I think, even though I love Suspiria, I think Inferno is actually better than Suspiria. Not by much, but only so much in how the film itself was told, like how the narrative was told. I liked getting the exposition as to what was going on. It didn't spoil anything. It's called tapping into the zeitgeist. I didn't want to call it the zeitgeist because that's kind of like the collective of everything, whereas horror's kind of, I guess, the horror zeitgeist. Yeah, I would say the horror zeitgeist. Thank you, Aaron. So in that sense, I think that this film is stronger, that Inferno is stronger, because it is a perfect blend of Dario's thematic cinematography and Bava's ability to tell a story and to tell it in a way that the audience can quickly follow along with it and enjoy both sides. That there is a time when ensuring the audience is looking at the screen and really taking in what you're trying to say. You know, it's kind of like the difference between someone who's like the art film and the film you make because you know it'll make money, it'll be popular. Art films, you know, require a certain level of attention, you know, in order to get everything that the director is trying to, or the writer are trying to tell you. You know, mainstream films, you can pretty much glean what's going on without it having to be a visual feast And, you know, either way, there's a quality there. And I think that Inferno was the perfect blend between the two, which is why I really thoroughly enjoyed these two ones. It's a departure from Suspiria. And of course, we went back to that. You know, we go back to Dario's original style with The Mother of Tears in 2007. But I really love this. And the fact that Argento didn't fight Bava on this. So we got this beautiful balance between surrealistic Argento and formulaic Argento, where he allowed the story to tell itself. And we got a lot of cool. The information in this one was pretty much, think of Inferno like the movie that gave all the missing information from Suspiria. So the idea that there's these three witches, and then we're kind of glancing at this kind of like, it's kind of like moment in life, this moment in time of what's going on in Suspiria. And then we get all of the background information in Inferno. And then with those two combined, we then go into Mother of Tears, which unfortunately did not, I don't think, panned out the way Argento intended that to. So nonetheless, a really, really solid film. The beautiful thing I think on this one, the set pieces are absolutely amazing. Bava did an incredible job. If for those who don't know, if you watch the film, a lot of those building sets that you see, okay, I shit you not, are mats. So mats and miniatures created by Mario Bava. And they are literally, milk cartons with pictures pasted on them, with pictures like attached to them to create those sequences. So not real, which is really phenomenal. I just really love that. So there's some magnificent practical effects in this one, not to mention some solid, the monsters and the gore effects are pretty intense. I will say that the animal action may put some people off their lunch. There's several scenes of animals eating other animals in this. So I think the lizard eating the moth, I think that's one thing, but the cat eating the mouse is pretty rough because that's legit. So there are some scenes of, there's some animal action, not to mention the sequence when the old antiques dealer tries to, like, you know, puts all the cats in the bag and you tries to take them out to the swamp and tries to drown, dumps the bag of cats in the swamp and then gets eaten by all the rats. So it's really, really intense. There's some really intense shit in this film, like really, really hardcore. So some of that it's classic Argento stuff where he's not going to shy away from the horrors of what is being implied. He doesn't do implied horror. He shows it full force, that's where he goes with it. So there's some pretty intense stuff in this one. There really, really is. And I think that if you're a fan of Argento's work, specifically of Italian horror or Italian cinema, if you like Lamberto Bava, if you like Mario Bava's work, if you like Argento, if you like, any of the stuff, if you're looking at stuff like Cannibal Holocaust or Zombie, I think that you will dig this one. Or even some of the Giallo stuff, like House by the, like horror films like House by the Cemetery. I think that you will dig this. Omni Orozboro says, I've seen Pink Flamingos. I can handle anything. Good point, Fucking John Waters, man. Crazy. Operation Free World, good to see you. Says, oh my God, I can finally make it. Good to see you, Operation. Thanks so much for hanging out. Tapping into the Frightgeist. I like that. Tapping into the Frightgeist. So Inferno, I think, is an underrated horror film. I don't see too many people talking about it. I think because everybody gets fixated on Suspiria because of Dario's unique style. Suspiria stands out because of its visual appeal, and because of the unique surrealistic cinematography, Dario's use of light and how to convey things. Especially, I love his combination his combinations of reds and blues and how they whether it's crossed across where he cuts the frame between the two colors, then moves in between each one. I love how he does that so effortlessly, how he plans all that in. It's brilliant stuff. Bava uses it as well, and, kind of like, uses it to great effect. I love the way he frames things, his use of how he moves the camera instead of cutting always. He'd rather move the camera through the action, which I really, really like. Let the set, let the colors, let the light, let the actors speak for what's going on. Don't try to tell the story with the camera. Let the things going on in front of the camera tell the story, which I love. That's old school mentality. It's old school Hollywood mentality. I love that Dario, adheres to that. And so this has got to be, in my personal opinion, the best of the three. Of the three Mothers films, this is my favorite. This is my number one. Just a hair above Suspiria. Because I have a stomach for surrealistic horror, but this one I really dug because it felt like a beautiful combination of the two. You know, I also want to point out, thank you so much to Sir Chasm, who's been a member of the Army of the Dead for 8 months. Thank you so much for the support. Joshua Lee, who's also been a member for 8 months. Thank you, Joshua Lee. And Operation Free World, who just became a member of the Army of the Dead. Thank you so very, very much. I do appreciate that, Operation Free World. You rock. So thank you to you new members. Please enjoy all the cool horror icon emojis that I've made for you. I hope you enjoy them. So yeah, but that being said, Inferno, very unique, probably one of the best horror films. I would say probably, if you would say like top horror films, definitely in the top, I would say top 25 horror films of all times. But Argento is a master and always has been. I don't care that, you know, there's a bit of a decline there. You know, you can't stay on top forever. He's got his position in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. He was kicking ass, taking names. He's one of the legends out there. So my question for the audience is, of all of them, Argento's unique style, his unique vision, his surrealistic take on horror, his examination on not only the external, but the internal, keeping with the Italian theme that horror is both what's coming at you and what is coming from within you. You know, the thing that makes Italian horror fantastic. You know, that the demons are often what we like. The idea that the haunted house is, you know, the haunted house is often haunted by the demons we bring into the house, you know, and the house is just reflecting them back at us. Stuff like that. I love that shit. And so of Dario Argento's filmography, tell me down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com, what is your favorite out of all of them Argento horror film? Because if the ones you've seen, if you've seen a bunch of them, I'd love to know what your favorite one is. Inferno is definitely my number one, just above Suspiria. You know, but there's a number of other films of his that I absolutely adore. I think he's just, yeah, he's just up there as far as the amazing stuff. Yeah, I mean, if you look at like The Cat of Nine Tails, fucking Phenomena with Jennifer Connelly was fantastic. Tenebrae is amazing. We talked about his film Opera here on the show. I think it was like last season we talked about Opera, and that was an amazing one as well. So he's got really excellent shit, not just the Three Mothers trilogy. Really excellent films. We've talked about a number of them. So let me know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com what your favorite, all time, all of them, what your favorite Dario Argento horror film is. Love to hear your thoughts on that. Let me know. All right. Moving on to our next one. This is a fascinating one. So released April 3rd, 2020, we have the film Agony, another Italian horror film. So it's a film set in Italy, but it, you know, like a cross production. But let's check out this trailer. Let's cue up the terror tube. All right. So that was the trailer for Agony. So formerly titled The Executrix. The film is directed by Michael Civetta and written by Michael Civetta and Joseph Schumann. Michael Civetta, ex-husband to Asia Argento. And of course, starring Asia Argento, daughter of Dario Argento. Jonathan Coet, Monica Ghiertore, Ninetto Davoli, the legendary Franco Nero, and of course, Roddy Serbadegia. The film follows Asia Argento's character as she finds out that her mother has recently died after thinking her mother's been dead for 30 years. And that upon her mother's death, that her mother's estate and her title have been passed down to her from back in Tuscany. And so she goes with her family to Tuscany to try and settle the estate and winds up uncovering a mystery as to the circumstances of her mother's death, why exactly it was hidden from her for so long, and what was actually going on. And of course, supernatural events are constantly going on all around her. But the question then becomes, is there something really crazy going on, or is it all in her mind? Because there's the possibility that she might be mentally ill, or her mother was as well. So, so there's something to be said here as far as this goes. Now, there are some... there's some difficult things to say here regarding the film Agony. The film in and of itself is actually not bad at all. It's not a bad film by any stretch. It's well acted in the areas it needs to be acted in. It's got a number of great legendary actors in it. Roddy Serbadegia is, Franco Nero is good in it. I wish they'd utilize Nero better because he has so much more to offer than just playing a bit part across from Asia Argento. Asia is solid in the sense that she's good in an ensemble. It's always been my position that she's better in an ensemble than she is trying to lead, because Asia has always had, she's a phenomenal actress. She's really, really good. I mean, heck, I mean, when she won Best Actress in the essentially the Italian equivalent of the Oscars 2 years in a row for her work, she's an excellent actress. But, you know, Asia's got two modes. You know, she's got normal and she's got 100 miles an hour. Yeah, that's what it is. You know, she knows when to hit that switch and go in those directions. So, but Asia's also a bit of a controversial figure in a number of ways, not just, you know, outside of the industry, within the industry, but nonetheless, a very talented actress and has done some decent work. Does some really decent work, some really, really good stuff. The fascinating one about this one, I think, is not so much what goes on, because while in Agony, the set pieces are amazing. They shot on location in Tuscany. It's absolutely beautiful country, not to mention the time of the year that they shot. It's misty, it's dim, you know, it's just after the harvest. So you've got this kind of like end of year feel going on. It's a combination kind of like lightly, you know, you got like the environment plays into it as well. Not to mention this giant Tuscany estate that is both, you know, because back then they built them to last. So it's you know, parts decrepit, parts, you know, opulent. And I always love it when the set says as much about what's going on, and with the set pieces and the setting say as much about what's going on than as the actors themselves. And it's brilliant. I love the architecture of old Italy. So that all plays very, very well. It's a beautifully shot film, excellently shot, with some really, really fascinating cinematography choices, some classic giallo tropes that are in there, with some, you know, with the quick zoom ins and the angles of, you know, like focusing on eyes, you know, retaining information. And so there's some really, really interesting stuff at work here. A little bit too much hanging on of just those classic tropes or to sell it, but it works. You know, those tropes work. That's why we're not going to slide them for doing that. The interesting thing here, and I will say, I'm not going to spoil it because this one came out in 2020 is when this one released. So, and it's only 4 years. It's only been 4 years off. So I'm not going to spoil the ending. We're still within that time appearing for the moratorium on spoilers. But the ending didn't annoy me. And I'll say that oftentimes that kind of ending will annoy me. But the way it played into it, I think the way the film kind of slides into that was so effortless in the way the film was shot and how they were connected. I thoroughly enjoy. I mean, I was like, it didn't, but I was like, oh, I didn't have the, oh, come on. You know, I was like, really? It didn't feel, it did, like that whole scenario did not feel like a cop-out. Usually that kind of ending feels like a cop-out to me. This time is a rare moment when it did not. So that's one thing the film has going for it. But nonetheless, overall, the film is just not as, it's not one of those grandiose explorations of, you know, grandiose character explorations. We've seen the story told before, you know, protagonist, you know, gets pulled to, you know, to find out, or your protagonist gets pulled into old family mystery. Solves mystery, chaos ensues, you know, denouement. It's pretty much it. You know, there's nothing original going on here. The interesting thing I hear lies in what's behind the scenes. So there's no need for the TP-9000 on this one. The film wasn't middling. It has some good bright points. But I think I think the only thing that does a disservice is Asia herself. Because, like I said, Asia's got two modes. She's either going 100 miles per hour, or she's just, you know, like, just, you know, like class, just normal. She's like normal behavior. It's either like normal, like 30 miles per hour or 100 miles per hour. She's got two speeds. And trying to do a descent into madness piece is very difficult when you only have two speeds. You've got to slowly ramp up into that. And her journey into madness is so staccatoed. You know, and it just goes like ramps down, ramps. It's almost like this. And that really takes us out. Because if we don't feel the slide with her, if we're not with her on that, or if we're internalizing the trauma or the supernatural horror, if we're not internalizing that at the same rate as she does, then it's going to put us out of the film. That's just the one thing. I think that's the only bad thing really going for it. Is, I hate to say, because she's very talented, I just don't think she was the right choice to play this film. But here's what's interesting, is that the backstory behind this. So, directed by her, at the time, husband, Asia's husband, cast her in the film. Her husband is obviously taking a lot of notes from prior legends. There's a lot of Dario Argento in this one, a lot of Asia's father in this one. There's some Bava in there. There's a number of excellent filmmakers that he took inspiration from. Another number of Gallo directors that he took inspiration from to get this thing across. Okay. The interesting thing here is the relationship between Asia and her father. And if you're not familiar with this, I think that this lends some very interesting backstory to what's going on in this film, not just from a narrative perspective, but what's going on with Asia's performance in this film, which I find really fascinating. Regular Jeff, good to see you, bud. Thanks so much for being here tonight. So for those in the know, obviously, the relationship between Asia and Dario, for lack of a better term, would be estranged. The two of them really don't get along, and Asia has been more vocal about it than Dario has, and that her relationship with her dad has always been strained. She described her life coming up with, you know, her young life as very depressing and very alone. And the only reason she got into acting was to have a relationship with her father. And the reason she was so alone is because her mother, Daria Nicolodi, and her father, Dario Argento, the only reason that she was alone was because they were constantly working. Her mother was a working actress, father's a working director, constantly, you know, out there, you know, working gig to gig, and so she had a very lonely upbringing. And so to have a relationship with her parents, or with her father the most, she went into acting. She herself has stated that she really does not like the idea of, like, the celebrity. Like, so, like, acting should be about telling a story. It should be about conveying something for the audience. And the whole celebrity aspect really puts her off. She is not a fan of that. In fact, I think to quote her, she said it disgusts her. The idea that someone needs to perform because they so desperately need the attention for being someone else instead of just being themselves. So it's a fascinating take, you know. It almost feels like, you know, I can understand she's staying true to herself, but I say that, you know, also biting the hand that feeds you is also very, very dangerous. I get it, you know, but the industry is an industry of politics. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Be honest and true to yourself, but recognize there may be consequences, because the potty push, the bean counters, don't like it when you slight their bean counting choices. You know, it's just the way it is. So Asia, I think in an attempt to bridge that gap with her dad, you know, and she's often said that the best relationship she ever had with her father, the only time her father was her father was when her father was her director. Hence the Mother of Tears, when Aaron Reese brought that up in the chat. So she has this viewpoint as to her relationship with the men in her life, with the men in her life. And I think that translates itself very much so to her characters, to how she treats men, how she views men throughout the characters she plays. I think that informs her acting, in my personal opinion. If I were an instructor, I would say a bit too much. I think it's just that's her style. That's the energy she brings to these roles. So the difficulty here is that there is so much Dario in this film with the color choices. You'll notice the slides from blue to red, the blue and red hues that are utilized, especially in the flashback sequences or the transition sequences, the cinematography, the way light is utilized to cut through the frame, the way the camera moves languidly through a scene. That's all Dario. I think it's my opinion, after watching this film twice, because I had to like really, really pay attention to it. I honestly think that Agony, and this is totally my opinion, I could be completely off base because I don't know Asia personally. So I'm just going off what I know of what she's talked about and what I know about what Dario's talked about. So I think that Agony is essentially that this film was driven by Asia to get made. That her then husband directed it and partially wrote it, with her in mind, even though they've never commented on this, and that the idea of the film in and of itself is for Asia to reconcile those issues she has with her family. Because essentially, that's what's going on in this. Asia rejects her father, played by Reza Sabadegia. She rejects her father angrily. And we're talking like, you know, turn on a dime. Talk to you normally. Within 5 seconds, you say one sentence. And she never wanted to hear a word he said anyway. That's the relationship she has with her dad. The relationship she's struggling to have with her mother because her mother's passed away, but now she feels like she's been lied to her entire life. She's struggling to find some connection with the mother that she didn't know she had and didn't know who she was. So she's trying to find that familial background with what she's missing. You know, what's this part that's missing in front of her? And now she suddenly got this. This mystery has been unveiled, and now she's diving into it to try and find all the secrets. What are people keeping from her? Because everybody's lying to her, and so, or she feels that they are. But then she goes after it, and she winds up alienating everybody that's around her in her search for herself. I think that this film has more going for it on the personal aspect, which I think is a fascinating look. Not because the film in and of itself is fascinating, as far as the story goes, but I think the film is fascinating as a look into Asia Argento herself. The relationship she has with Dario, how Dario's influence informed her husband into the making of this movie, her search for her mother, who has sadly since passed away, her search for her mother's identity, because she has expressed that she really only knew her mother as a person through her father. So everything had this veneer on it that she couldn't break through. And now as an adult, she's attempting to grasp that, to find it again. Which is why, despite the fact that the film is not so great, I think the film is deeply personal. And that's what made it more interesting the second time I watched it. After watching it for all the technical stuff, and then watching it through to see what Asia really brings to it, see her interaction with her husband and with her daughter, and you'll notice the way it's written. And I don't know if this plays into the fact that Asia and her husband are no longer together anymore, but if you'll notice, Asia doesn't come out, you know, as the character, she doesn't come out looking so fantastic in this. You know, in the search for herself, in the search for her identity, in the search to uncover this, in the search for the justice for the lies that were told to her, she winds up alienating her husband, alienating her daughter, completely writing off her father, and turning on everybody around her, until eventually she descends into absolute insanity and winds up in the predicament she was in the third act, which, you know, if you'll understand when you watch the movie, wraps around, I don't want to spoil it, but wraps around and close up full circle, and you'll see and you'll recognize, ah, is it better to know or simply to, or like, it's that asking that question, you know, can you know too much? What are you willing to sacrifice for the closure that you think you need? And I think that's what's going on in this particular film. I think it's a deeply personal film for Asia, and I think she put everything she had into it. I think she really did, you know? But I think her personal life informed this one so much, and this is a fantastic example, Agony is, of how our personal lives influence us in the film industry. Whether it's, and I think that her husband's awareness of this, and her husband at the time's awareness of this, showcased in the writing itself, showcasing that it's not just Dario that's at fault. It's not just Nickelodeon, her mother, Nickelodeon, who's at fault. But Asia plays a role as well, and that it's up to her, as evidenced by the third act, it's up to her to break the cycle. And so I found the film fascinating in that respect. Oftentimes, it's the stories behind these things that really, really give them their gravitas. And I think that that's also what's unfortunate. It shouldn't have to be the stories behind a film that give the film its weight. But unfortunately, it sometimes is. And a lot of people are not going to go looking for this information to try and find why this film is a bit deeper and has more going on than what people would often suspect. A lot of critics wrote, you know, like they reviewed this film and they wrote about it. They kind of like wrote it off as, some people said it was a middling effort. Some people said it was, you know, it was Asia trying her absolute best, but, you know, herself is in, you know, her career is also in decline, same as her father's, that almost like her father's an anchor and kind of dragging her down with him. Maybe she's just getting older and she's getting sick and tired of it. I don't know. But a lot of critics kind of, you know, came out of very, very lukewarm, except for the hardcore horror ones. They gave it, you know, like 2 thumbs up, is beautifully shot, all the things that we rave about. But I think that those are the individuals that know, that understand the personal shit that really informed this movie, from both the writing that her husband lent to it and to what Asia brought to the film. With that in mind, I would recommend, if you haven't had a chance to see this personified crossroads between an estranged father and daughter reconciling their past, and oftentimes how that conversation is so one-sided that oftentimes one side ends up filling in the blanks for the other ones, and that's not always right, because assuming what they'll say can sometimes lead you to further disaster, you know? So I think that that's the importance of this one, is the look into the personal stuff. So with that in mind, I would recommend, if you only watched the film once, or knowing if you haven't watched it yet, go and check out Agony. You know, it's on Tubi right now. It's for free, so you don't have to pay for it. And definitely go check it out. And I think with that in mind, knowing what we know about Asia and the struggles that she had in her youth, the struggles she had when she was establishing herself, her personal takes on the differentiation between acting and performing, and the celebrity identity, you know, and where she stands in the middle of that, thrust into the limelight because of the weight of her father's name, thrust into the limelight because of her father, you know, because she's an Argento. Looking for herself in a community of people who ostensibly make their livings or live their lives being other people, you know? Trying to find her past with a father that won't speak to her, and she rarely speaks to, she probably doesn't speak to him, and a mother who is now gone. That's the fascinating shit that really informs this. And I think with that in mind, we can see Asia's performance for what it really is. And that it's not so much acting, which I think is really, really fascinating. Because for Asia, I think in this respect, it wasn't just a role she was playing. So I find that really, really interesting, you know, definitely. Casey Cooper says jail. Oh, yeah. Omni Orsboro says jail's going deeper. Yes, I'll always go deeper. Casey Cooper says jail is a horror philosopher. Sometimes I am. I found this one so fascinating. Not for the film. The film itself, you know, I've seen the story a dozen times. We all have seen that story a dozen times before. You know, person living, living somewhere else. Protagonist living somewhere else gets message. Come home. Resolve issue. Protagonist returns home. Is confronted with mystery or family curse. You know, fight. Solves mystery or breaks family curse. Protagonist is changed. Moves forward, or protagonist dies. It's one of the two. You know, we've seen it. I mean, this is a classic, you know, a classic one. But I think in this particular one, yes, Angel Rivera says life imitating art, imitating life. I think that it's what's going on behind the scenes. What's going on with Asia? What's going on with her is what gives this film its weight. So if you'd be willing to, definitely check the movie out. There's a lot of sequences that are subtitled, that they're in Italian. So, yeah, I mean, you may have to deal with that one. If you don't like subtitles, then that may put you off. But There's plenty of English in it as well, and you'll be able to follow along. So I definitely, you know, recommend this one. Ondine, hello, says, Ondine says hello from France to my friends. Good to see you, Ondine. Thanks so much for hanging out. Appreciate you being here. Operation Free World says, Jail watches movies with the third eye. My pineal gland is fully open when I'm watching this stuff. It really, really is. So, like I said, now, some people may be put off by Asia. I know a lot of people don't like her. She's very, very outspoken and somewhat of a controversial figure in Hollywood. But I will say, as far as an actor goes, we can separate the person from the product. I think that we can do that. And I think this film speaks a great deal to the actress herself. And I think, in my opinion, of the films I've seen her in, definitely one of her more personal roles. So, Given that being said, if you are a fan of Asia Argento, if you have liked her work, whether it's her classic Italian work or the work she's done here in America or whatever, if you are, what do you think has been her best performance to date? The best Asia Argento film? Let me know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you are an Asia Argento fan, just let me know what is your favorite of her filmography. She's got a bunch. She's got a pretty extensive list of work. So let me know. Dr. Design, good to see you. Says, I'm late. I hope I didn't miss the air horn moment. Not even close. You know, we're a good ways off. So you're good to go. But Raven Darkstar, I don't think I've seen Raven here yet. I think Raven hasn't said anything and is hoping that I won't play it. But you'd be wrong, Raven. If you are listening, you would be wrong. You would. All right. Let's move on to our next film. And I promise you, this is the dip before the rise. Dip before the rise. You know, it really, really is. I promise you. Released April 4th, 2014. We have the found footage horror film Alien Abduction. Too bad Johnny O's not here because he would give this one a right trubbing. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. All right. That was the trailer for Alien Abduction. Oh, what to say about this one? So, also known as the Morris Family Abduction, found footage science fiction horror film, the directorial debut of Maddie Beckerman and written by Robert Lewis, starring Catherine Sigismund, Corey Ide, Riley Polanski, Jillian Clare, Jeff Bowser, and Peter Holden. The film follows a family as they are going out camping in North Carolina by Brown Mountain. And apparently one night, they see some interesting, they see UFOs, the film's called Alien Abduction. So they see like lights in the sky. And then the next day, the aliens have landed, people are getting abducted and all fucking hell breaks loose. They wind up seeking a shelter with this, backwoods country boy who looks so much like Aaron Reese. It's shocking. And, but then of course, as Eugene would say, shit gets real. This one, unfortunately, unlike some other alien abduction films, there are good ones, okay? Fire in the Sky is good. Extraterrestrial is good by the Vicious Brothers. That one is fantastic. There have been so many good ones, but obviously we're going to get our bad ones. And the things that, Tang Whistle herself says, bleh, hard pass. I totally understand where you're talking about this one. So, first and foremost, if you are into UFOs, if you like the phenomena, if you follow the phenomena, anybody who's in the who's in that group, who's a member of that subculture knows that the Brown Mountain lights have long since been debunked. Okay? They were first reported, I believe, in the late 1800s, and it was shortly after that, like less than 20 years after they were first identified, first reported, it was less than 20 years later that they were debunked. So the Brown Mountain lights are not something that are out. It's not like the Bermuda Triangle or the Marfa light. No, even the Marfa lights, I think those have been explained as well. So pretty much regular Jeff. Yeah, you did see the whole movie in the trailer. You kind of did. You pretty much did. This came out this came out 10 years ago. So I'm not worried about spoilers. Essentially, this one has so many things working against it that the film itself really can't work. And I think make some very, very terrible narrative choices. Number one, the writing choice or it's got to be the writing choice. The fact that essentially the camera, how to break this down? And I'm not trying to salvage it. I'm just trying to express this because this is so difficult. When you're shooting found footage, the person who has the camera is extra. Thank you, Case Cooper. Another excellent one. When you're shooting found footage, the person who has the camera is supposed to inform the sense of the scene when you have multiple cameras, because each person is different. And so each person shoots differently. They hold the camera differently. They move differently. So that's one of the appeals of found footage, is you can get multiple narrative takes via different people with different people with cameras. Okay, that's the whole point. Stationary cameras are supposed to be like security cameras, CCTV, shit like that. We pop up a camera here in the corner so we can watch the scene. And those are supposed to be the shots that are used for your transitional shots or for your big set pieces, because those are the ones that can be manipulated the most easily. If you look at a movie like Grave Encounters, found footage film, but interspersed with stationary cameras. Those where there's webcams that they put up in the different areas that they post up at the top. Those capture a wide shot. Those are your wide shots. And those are the ones that you can go in and manipulate so you can see like some big action, like a guy getting thrown out a window or a person getting sucked into a bathtub and shit like that. But the handheld ones are supposed to evoke the emotions of the person who's carrying the camera. This allows us to follow through the emotional experience as the audience, to follow through the emotional experience of each individual character. Because remember, not everybody's going to be on camera at the same time. We're not getting equal distribution like we're normally shooting. So the way you know what's going on with the character is the way they're holding the camera and the way they're shooting stuff. How afraid they are, what their emotional state is, when they pull the camera away, whether, you know, all the, that's what's important. That's why that's a narrative thing, okay? When you make your camera in the found footage a single person thing, and then and in order to convey that you're only going to get one emotional state through the whole movie, in order to avoid that, you make the character autistic, I think was an extraordinarily lazy decision. Not to mention, kind of off-putting in that respect. Given what it's meant to be. Now, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the general public, who are not like deep into films, like people like me, Eugene, Johnny, like us, or like a lot of people in the live chat here. We're all deep into films. And likely you noticed this. I think from the general audience perspective, they probably wouldn't be aware of this. I think it's actually not only a lazy fucking decision, because you purposely describe the person as, the character is autistic, and the person is non-affect. They're communicative, but they don't really show affect. So that conveys a kind of non-emotional or non-biased camera perspective. That means that the camera will hold on things longer than it normally would. Okay, so because you're not getting the emotional effect of the person holding the camera, so you get that kind of it becomes a bit more like a stationary cam. Equating that effect, or achieving that effect, or you to being autistic, I think is not only, I don't think they did it intentionally. I think it's inadvertently disrespectful because it's such a lazy fucking choice. And to say like, he needs the camera, that's what makes him comfortable. You take it away from him, he'll freak out. That's why he has to have the camera. And he's always recording. I think it's incredibly lazy. The film itself is very lazy. It unfortunately takes some pretty decent moments. There's some acting moments that I think were well done, and some shots like the tunnel sequence was pretty good. The sequence in the shack was pretty good. The way the lighting is utilized quite a bit was well done in some areas. But overall, the film is just lazy. It's just another drop in the bucket. It's another one of those cash grab films that's jumping on the alien phenomenon. This came out in 2014, and I looked into it at the time. We were starting to get the rise up in, you know, people questioning UFOs and what the Defense Department knows about it. So there was a spate of these fucking things that were dropping out. You know, how involved is the government? Does the government know about it? What are the government not telling us? Because people don't trust the government. You know, they haven't for years. So what are they lying to us about? Blah, blah, blah. And so that kind of like became a big topic. And so this script got greenlit. They ran with it. And that's pretty much what this is. It's just a media talking point cash grab is all this film is. The characters there's nothing to invest in here. No one's really super likable. The dad becomes really unlikable very, very quickly. The mom is worthless. The only two solid one, like, the only solid character is the daughter. And it ends badly. It ends on a bad note. Nobody makes it out of this, which is wild because you'd think that, and then they do the whole like Project Blue Book thing, because the Project Blue Book, you know, the Blue Book cronies come in and they cover everything up. So that's why people didn't know about this mass disappearance of like freaking like what looks to be like 40 people in the area just vanished. And then one of them pops back up in the credits. If you watch the credits, the dad pops back up. Like they drop him back off like months later. So it's lazily done. The opening interviews are terrible. They just don't work because it's all staged. Obviously, those who know UFOs are familiar with the subgenre or familiar with that subculture. The Brown Mountain Lights have been long since debunked. It's a throwback to the X-Files, because the X-Files had an episode where the Brown Mountain Lights were investigated. It didn't turn out to be aliens, but that's the mushroom episode when they found Mully and Skull underground. They were hallucinating all the time. So they were hallucinating everything. They were being devoured. They were slowly digested by the giant fungal, by the giant mushroom. So this one, I think, is just, it can't do anything right, is the problem. Every time it tries to build tension, it falls into a trope, or it inadvertently reminds me of how fucking lazy this is. The characterizations are lazy. Nobody makes smart decisions. Everybody's just dumb and freaking out. So it's like literally the worst of the worst across the board. The film itself is just ultimately in the end is just kind of boring in that respect. You know, like there isn't even the what would you do. The only what would you do question is, you know, you would do nothing of what these characters did. Not to mention, and the worst travesty, we barely get any fucking aliens. What's the point? If you're going to have people getting abducted, if you're going to have these devastating scenes where the cars are all left open and their personal belongings are strewn everywhere, and obviously there's like multiple people missing, and then all we get is backlit aliens, you know, and then like a couple of frames of when like one pokes up, it's like, oh, I'm an alien. And then like a hand grabbing you. It's like, why? So lazy writing, lazy direction, inadvertently insulting directorial choices, you know, cheap cinematography, bad characters, piss poor writing, and no fucking aliens. In fact, the only real effect that you get, like, you know, was the shit moving in the sky. Fucking pointless, you know? It's just fucking disappointing. And this is the reason, and this is one of the many reasons why found footage gets fucked up and why no people just disassociate themselves from it. They just don't like it. It throws you out of the movie, is the point. There's found footage films I fucking like. Who was it? Somebody mentioned it. Operation Free Roll 10. Speaking of Grave Encounters, the scene at the end where Sean finally puts the camera down once he's fucked, despite being the one who wanted to keep rolling the whole time, it captured the hopelessness. Exactly. Okay? And if you watch that, yeah, I have to go back and look to remember all the characters' names. But the way each one of them approaches it, you know, and the fact that Sean's relationship with the camera, whether he's holding it or how he's holding it, and how his character is used to being in front of it all the time, that informs it, because everybody else is not used to being in front of the camera like Sean is. And so their relationship with the camera is different than his. And I love the fact that the Vicious Brothers further explored that in the sequel, because of when finally they discover him rotting in the bowels of the thing for the past 9 years, how when all of a sudden there's a camera there again, that part of his personality kicks back in where there's a camera. Oh, and then all of a sudden he kind of remembers who he was, because that's his relationship. That thing right there is a part of his identity. You know, I love how they re-referenced that. How they brought that back in of like what one of Sean's biggest failings was and the reason why he led his crew to their doom. So that's excellent fucking writing, you know? That's filmmakers who understand what they're doing and not trying to just do a cash grab. If you watch the movie Extraterrestrial has some found footage moments in it, but it's not a found footage film. It does, because they only use the found footage in that one to kind of move through a scene or to set up like a big take, like a big wide shot, which is really, really good. So nonetheless, Alien Abduction, you can pass on this one. Or if you want to watch, see how bad it is, I wish I could say it's silly or inadvertently funny, but it's not. It's the reason why people reject found footage, why found footage has such a terrible, such a terrible reputation. Because this is just cheap ass, lazy ass filmmaking at its core. Not to mention some kind of offensive shit in there. I won't lie. I don't like what they did with that. Utilizing an autistic person as a fucking prop in order to justify the way you're telling your story, in my opinion, is fucking bullshit. So I'll say that. And it's probably why, I'm not going to lie, Maddie Beckerman hasn't done much shit since Alien Abduction in 2014. Maddie has done some stuff, like, you know, as far as behind the scenes goes, but as far as it goes, you know, like career-wise, not fantastic, you know. Yeah, not great. Casey Cooper says, tell us how you really feel, JL. Yeah, you'll always get the truth from me as far as what I think. I really do. Tang Whistle says, to date, I've watched maybe a half dozen found footage films, and the first Cloverfield was the only one I really got into, and it still gave me motion sickness on some bits. Absolutely. Blair Witch, with the Blair Witch Project was the one that got me. I saw that one in theaters. That one left me kind of queasy as well because of the motion sickness, but the experience was amazing. I loved it, and it really solidified in my mind that, you know, all you need is some cameras and a script ID. You can go out and shoot something. Not saying it's going to be good, but you can do that. Get some cameras together. Borrow them if you have to, okay? Get a boom mic. Get some lav mics, whatever. Record your sound and your video separately. Go out and fucking shoot. That's how you start. If you look at the careers of individuals like Sam Raimi, they went out, Sam Raimi, Wes Craven, Sean S. Cunningham, a number of those directors that we grew up with in the 70s and the 80s. If you look at those individuals, they went out and they fucking shot. Always, they just be shooting something, you know? You never know the friends you're going to make. You never know the connections you're going to build. Go out and shoot for the love of fucking shooting. And that can be the start of everything. Not guaranteed you're going to be the next Sam Raimi or the next Wes Craven or the next Sean S. Cunningham. But fuck, we know, you know, the world knows we need a new Wes. We need the next Wes Craven. We really do. But Peter Jackson as well. Just go out and fucking shoot. You know, that's the whole point. Shoot and tell the story. That's the key. And we need more of that. But this kind of shit, this cash grab shit, we can do away with it. But nonetheless, I will say this. Alien abduction horror films, there are some good ones out there. This is not one of them. Alien abduction, terrible fucking name, is not one of them. Okay? The Fourth Kind is pretty damn good. You know? There's that one with Kerry Russell. I can't remember the title of it. Where they target the family in the house to kidnap one of the sons. Was it The Fourth Kind with Mila Jovovich? You got fucking Fire in the Sky. You got Extraterrestrial. You know, you got a bunch of good ones. Dark Skies, thank you. Dark Skies. There are a bunch of good ones out there. Okay? My question for the audience is, because I know the answer ain't this one. What do you think has been the best alien abduction horror film? The best alien abduction horror film that's done the best, whether it was the aliens or whether it was the ships or whether it was like the tension or the horror, you know, whatever. Let us know down in the comments below at weekendhorror@gmail.com. What has been, in your opinion, the best alien abduction horror film? And I know it won't be this one. Yes, wrote another name. Signs was better than this one. Swing away. Hit him with water. You know, they came to a planet that 70% of the shit, that 70% is covered by the shit that kills them. Oh, M. Night Shyamalan. Oh, so silly. So silly. Skyline was better than this one. Predator 2. I like that. Predators. Predators was alien abduction. You know, better. Extro, also good. Got some good ones in there. I love it. Skyline. Yeah, Skyline with Eric Balfour. Yes! We talked about Eric Balfour last week. We talked about Backcountry and that little role he played with the unnecessary Irish accent as the ranger who doesn't tell them he's a ranger. It's fucked up. It's so, so dumb. But yeah, let us know down in the comments below. Love to hear people's thoughts on that. All right, we've got one more to talk about. It seems like we are right on schedule, or I've been able to keep it right on schedule. Absolutely. Dylan Prell. Okay. Communion is a great one, I think. So Communion with Christopher Walken. We talked about Communion this season, earlier this season. Communion is so fucking weird. That is such a weird fucking movie. Christopher Walken is brilliant. You know, Christopher Walken is great. But, you know, and Lindsay Krause. You know, I love Lindsay Krause. It was amazing seeing her, you know, seeing the young Lindsay Krause with young, you know, Christopher Walken in a relationship. Yeah, that was great. Acting was fantastic. But holy shit, that is a weird fucking movie. Based on a very weird book. A book written by an author who wrote Wolfen, which was phenomenal. You know, and that David Bowie vampire movie. But a great author, and Communion damn near derailed, damn near ended his career. The movie was so fucking weird because he claimed it was autobiographical. So, like, he's telling the story of his own alien abduction. You know, a fantastic, phenomenal, legendary author writes this book Communion, gets adapted into a film starring Christopher Walken. That movie was fucking weird. Very weird. You know, definitely a strange one. But we got one more to talk about tonight. Yes, with an Eric Clapton soundtrack, you know, and Christopher Walken dancing with aliens, dancing and making out with aliens. Very strange. Not to mention all the butt play. You know, just going to throw that out there. You know, the implied butt play. We'll say that. All right. With this next one, released April 5th, 1973, we have the Vincent Price classic, Theater of Blood. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the Terror Tube. Let me know in the chat if you love the Terror Tube. Yes, that was the trailer for Theater of Blood. Amazing fucking film. So, directed by Douglas Hickok and written by Anthony Greville Bell, as Stanley Mann and John Cohn. John Cohn, who came up with the idea, and starring Vincent Price, Diana Rigg, Ian Hendry, Harry Andrews, Robert Coote, Michael Hordern, and Robert Morley, and a number of others. If you're familiar with British cinema or British television, you will see them. Good night, Ondine. This is a wish you a sweet night in France. It is 2:45 a.m. Have a good rest. Thank you so much for joining us and popping in. It's always good to see you. Guest victims, yes. The film follows theater actor played by Vincent Price by the name of Lionheart. Make sure Edward Kendall Sheridan Lionheart, and he is seen after his supposed, you know, unaliving himself. He pops back up a year later to take revenge on the critics circle, the group of critics that derailed and destroyed his career. And he takes revenge upon them in the manner of Shakespearean plays, with each one of their deaths reflects a death in a particular play. He kills them in the manner of that, while during their deaths quotes the line from Shakespeare at the end of their death. It's magnificent. Everything is touched on, from Julius Caesar, Cymbeline, Troilus and Cressida, and The Merchant of Venice, Richard III, Romeo and Juliet, Othello. All of it is fantastic. So this one, if you did get a chance to watch it, you definitely must. Now, as far as, there's not much to spoil in this one. Vincent Price taking revenge on people, killing them in the manner of Shakespearean tragedies, you know, is just brilliant. The film is a fucking masterpiece. It absolutely is. Everything about the movie is, I could not find a fault for a 70s, at all in the 70s film. The brilliant thing about this one, and I love the fact that Vincent Price got to do it, is because, and it may come as a bit of a shock, Vincent Price didn't do, like, before this film, Vincent Price had done no Shakespeare. And he always wanted to do Shakespeare. You know, his capacity for melodrama, his capacity for, you know, his that voice, that baritone voice he has that could fill a room, you know, that laugh, that iconic laugh of his, his ability to emote with his face, his penchant for comedy and for drama, all of it plays so well. He's a phenomenally talented actor who I don't think got to spread his wings as often as I would have liked to have seen in different roles. I think he capitalized on what he was good at. But then again, he also had a lot of other things in his life that he was very talented at as well. So he was a multimedia artist. And so in this particular one, I love that you bring that up. The Abominable Dr. Phoebs, Left-Handed Jedi. We'll get to that. We will get to that. So I think in this one, Vincent Price goes above and beyond what we would normally expect from Vincent Price. And there are some key moments in this. First and foremost, the film is shot on location in England, and everything about the film, it works. The characters are sleazy and despicable, and we despise them. With the idea that these individuals are being, you know, are being punished in the sense of, you know, they destroyed this actor's career, this phenomenal stage actor's career, destroy his career, and then he revisits upon them the bloody retribution of the Shakespearean tragedies and does them not only in costume, but with the lines, and gives these performances as these individuals die. So he's giving them this encore performance before the death so they can see how wrong they were before he kills them in various ways, whether he's decapitating them in their sleep or he's cutting out their hearts, you know, dragged by horses, or even setting them up, like in the Othello murder, setting them up to kill their own spouse so they wind up in prison for the rest of their lives. The key seller in this, there's two brilliant things going on here, is Vincent Price's performance, the performance of Diana Rigg, who plays his daughter, is just are both fantastic. And obviously, you know it's Diana Rigg from the jump because she's masquerading as his assistant, who's, you know, supposed to be portrayed as a man. The big reveal, she's actually his daughter, which is a throwback to, you know, the roles of women being played by men in the days of Shakespeare. Well, she was a woman in the role of a man, and so the gender reveal there, as I think it was a nice little nod. But what really cements this one is Vincent Price. Vincent Price, stereotyped for, you know, his facial features, for his voice, for his iconic laugh, for his mastery, for his ability to blend comedy and horror elements, and also to wax, you know, kind of philosophically on the horrors that he produced, on the horror films that he made. I love those denouement moments where he gets to kind of like give us that little tidbit at the end. But in this one, I think is one of his best just straight storytelling, you know, like best narrative films. It used to be that The Mask of the Red Death was my all-time favorite Vincent Price film. But this one took the cake because not only is this one extremely well-written and extremely well-acted, by reports, the director stated that it was the easiest film. Douglas Hickok said it was the easiest film he'd ever had the pleasure of working on. All he had to do was turn the camera on and let the actors run. They knew their lines. They knew what they were going to do. It was all planned. He just turned the camera on and they just took it and ran with it. One takes, two takes, all over the place, knock the film out, not a problem. This is when you get that excellent, you know, ensemble of real professional, classically trained actors together who know how to sell this stuff. Vincent Price's mastery of Shakespeare is next level. It breaks my heart that we didn't get to see him do more. We've seen Ian McKellen, we've seen Patrick Stewart, we've seen Peter Cushing, we've seen Christopher Lee rocking the Shakespeare all day long. Maybe that's because they're all English. I don't know. Maybe because they're all British. I don't know. Vincent Price, he never really got that opportunity, and he deserved it because he was so good in all the roles. Richard III, Hamlet, you know, doesn't matter. He could have knocked these roles out of the park, and he showed that he's got the theater presence, the theatrical presence to do it, because he does it in multiple times across the board throughout this film. But there's this moment that is so beautiful. Of all the Vincent Price films I've seen, I think, and I've seen him get angry. We've all seen him get angry, seen him get righteously indignant, seen him get loud and big and boisterous and, you know, ha-ha, I'd command a scene. But the fence fighting sequence in this movie is by far the best sequence in this film. Not to mention the choreography was brilliant. Two guys going at each other with the pace, and one of them just, you know, arguably much better than the other one, is fucking him up left and right. It's just brilliant to watch. The trampling working like this, but Vincent Price is kicking the critic's ass. He decides to fight one of the critics, fence with the critics, a la Romeo and Juliet, the sword fight with Mercutio. He's going to, you know, take on this battle, and he's going to fight this guy, but he's not going to kill him just yet. There is a monologue he has in there when he finally has him dead to rights, and he could kill him, but he does, chooses not to. Expressing the anger, basically, this is where I think Vincent Price goes meta. And it's not often, but I think he goes meta. It's a very meta moment because it's the actor excoriating the critic for only serving the only goal that served is ultimately to tear down the performer, to quantify the performer in such a way that it puts them in a box. And it inherently, the idea of that is ultimately, it's reductive. Performance and expression is supposed to be this grand thing where anybody can take anything from it, depending upon either what angle you're viewing it from or your preconceptions you're bringing into it. But nonetheless, it's supposed to be this grand thing, this storytelling. That's what's important. And the critic comes along and reduces that effect. And the effect of the critic, essentially, is that it limits the actor in the eyes of the audience. Because the audience sees the performance, and then the audience reads the critic. And then the audience then, because the critic has the appeal of being there, because they're a critic. Not everybody's a critic. You know, they're published. They must know something. Maybe they know something I don't know, and ultimately reduces the performance to the numbers. And it takes the audience away from it. It steals the work from the actor, all the painstaking work, the choreography, the memorization, you know, all the hard work that goes into putting on a performance, especially a theatrical performance. I've been in many, and stage productions, woof. I love them. Stage will always be my first love, but they're fucking rough and they take it out of you, you know? And so knowing that, the monologue that he has when he expresses that the fucking venom that man spits in the middle of like fencing this dude to the death, carving him up with this effortlessly, you know, slashing this dude up with his foil. And then the guy's on the ground and he is expressing this. The venom that man spits had to be the most personal some of the most personal shit he has ever said. Because I think one of the reasons why Vincent Price didn't get the massive breaks that he deserved was because of critics. That's the issue. Yes, thank you, Legend of Jedi. He was from St. Louis. I think that's what it was. And he expresses himself in so beautifully and lays it down, you know, the break between the critic and the actor and the performer. The idea that this person who cannot do what the performer does, who cannot achieve what the performer does achieve in storytelling, gets their revenge by reducing the quality of what they do, by stealing a little bit from them. And that just, as a performer, that kills him. As a performer, that kills me. It really does. I'll be perfectly honest. I've been on the side of that. I've never like, you know, gone after a critic with a fencing foil. But I will say I felt that one of my best performances, and I was young when I took the role. I was way too young for the role. I was cast young, but I had a beard. I could grow a beard. My beard was already starting to turn white and everything because, you know, hair goes white in my family really quickly. And I had this, I was cast as Van Helsing in Dracula. It was my first stage gig out of film school. You know, I'm an actor, you know, I'm working now. So it's my first stage gig out of this. And I got cast as Van Helsing. I was 23 years old playing like a 65-year-old German man. I took dialect courses, accent courses. I got my German accent down from the very specific region that Van Helsing was from. You know, everything I could. The authentic look, you know, I smoked a pipe. The glasses that I wore, the hat that I wore, everything was, even the little detail, like little details, like I added the Masonic ring to the thing. This is my father's Masonic ring. So I added that to the character because it was visible from stage. So I added little details myself to really bring that in. So just brought it all together to perform this. And I got shredded. As a matter of fact, the entire play, the whole play got shredded by this one critic back in Dallas. And we just got eaten alive. Terrible. Terrible. And not to mention, I will say this, the play had a lot of problems with it. Bad director, bad adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, just not good. A lot of bad decisions on stage, a lot of bad decisions behind the scenes. But we bring to it as an actor, and I got shredded. Now, I personally felt, looking back over 20 years later, looking back, I think that was the best I could do with the time that I had. You imagine what I could do with that role now. Holy fuck. But I remember that. And I remember being so, and then, you know, it took some time. I was young. I was fresh. It took some time to get past that. I felt Vincent Price's, you know, his rage in that moment. You know, who is this person who doesn't act, who has never acted, to sit there and critique the hundreds of hours I put in to getting this character down and doing it service, doing it right, and not copying what Anthony Hopkins did. not copying what Peter Cushing did, making it my own, all the work that I did, and just cast it aside. I get it. I get the rage. I do. And I felt every ounce of that coming out of Vincent Price. Very personal moment. Well acted. Solidifies the whole thing. Not to mention that epic sequence towards the end, you know, the epic sequence towards the end where it's you know, it's essentially he's going to put the guy's eyes out. The last critic, he's going to put his eyes out to improve his vision. You know, I love the idea of that. Then he comes up and then the whole sequence when he's, you know, when he's carrying his dead daughter, his daughter dies, you know, he carries his dead daughter and he, you know, reciting the line from King Lear. Ah, it's so fucking brilliant. There are so many amazing moments, and this whole piece is driven by Vincent Price. His mastery of the balance between comedy and horror, and then the brilliance of the film in the writing sums up in the very, very end. We've got this whole thing. Bodies have been dropped all over the place. People getting their heads cut off, hearts cut out, dragged by horses, drowned in barrels of wine, you know, murdering their spouses. And it's all orchestrated by this one actor, you know, and his daughter. So it all comes down to it. And then finally, the police get onto him. Then the theater gets set on fire. Everybody dies. And his daughter dies. He's carrying his daughter, carries her to the top of the theater. And he's holding, gives that last performance. And of course, the cops come in. They've rescued the critic and they're outside. They're looking up. There he is up on the deal. And they see him up there. And he's like, he recites the line from the scene from King Lear. When he's lamenting, you know, he's kind of lost his mind. He's raving. And then the whole roof, collapses in. He falls to his death. And that's it. And then the critic looking up has the line is like a fascinating take on the role. But still a bit overacted. But you have to admit, he knows how to make an exit. And then the critic walks off. And then the cop, who's listening to him, like the detective, the detective inspector, like shakes his head and just like walks off the other direction. Like he didn't get it. So I like the whole point of it, like the critic missed the point, which I love. I love that idea. Despite the fact that it was in his face right there, hot smoking daggers going to go into his eyes in order to get this point across to him. And through this big epic production, boom, now he's dead, you know, like this, whatever, all these, you know, all this chaos has ensued, the carnage is done, the smoking ruins of the theater there, and all he can say is, you know, he can make, you know, it's like, he completely misses the fucking point, which is the whole meta point of the movie. The shit is fucking brilliant. Now, there is a connection here to Dr. Phoebes, the abominable Dr. Phoebes, because essentially, Theater in Blood, while not a remake of the abominable Dr. Phoebes, it has a lot of correlation to it. There is a killer taking revenge on I think it's like the same number of people. It's like 9 people. And then you've got the literature killing them in the ways that, you know, inspired by classic literature. That's all there. So there's a number of connections. You'll see that. But I think in my eyes, Theater of Blood is far superior to the abominable Dr. Phoebes. But Dr. Phoebes is still a classic film, but I honestly think that this one does better because of the presence of Vincent Price. Now, Abominable Dr. Phoebes did have Vincent Price, and it had Joseph Cotten, Hugh Griffith, and Terry Thomas, had a number of excellent ones. I don't think the set designs lent themselves, because it was mostly, if I remember correctly, it was mostly Art Deco, and the dark humor of it, didn't lend itself to that story, you know, despite the fact that it was written by, you know, William Goldstein and James Whitten. I also don't think that Robert Fuest's direction played that well. I think this one lent itself a lot better because that one had more religious overtones. Then this one had more, this one was definitely Shakespearean in both its tragedy and its storytelling. So I think this one plays a lot better. And I like the idea that Vincent Price was willing to jump on that in order to kind of retell that, in order to kind of like tell the story the way it should be told. He was decent he was great as Anton Phoebes. He really was. I just think that this story was better and a better vehicle for Price. There was more for him to do, more for him to connect with, which I think this one is the better version of the two. You know, I think Shakespeare was a better angle than I think it was like friggin' Jewish mythology, or like, you know, like Hebrew mythology, you know, the 10 plagues and shit like that. So, but yeah, I will say that. I will take on that one. So people have seen this. Yeah, if you've seen Abominable Dr. Phoebes but have not seen Theater of Blood, you will see overlap. But I just think that this one holds out better than Dr. Phoebes does. Just my personal opinion. I think just stronger overall. You know, maybe it's the fact that Vincent Price was more excited to do it. I'll give it that. I really do. So that being said, that's my question. But it comes down to Vincent Price himself, who played Dr. Phoebes and Lionheart. Dr. Phoebes and the Abominable Dr. Phoebes and Lionheart in Theater of Blood. Which one was the better villain? That's my question. This comes down to it. I'm very curious about this. The separation between the two. You know, the length of time between the two. You know, yeah, when you get more comfortable into that type, that specific type of role. Let me know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com. Which one do you think was Vincent Price's better villain? Dr. Phoebes or Lionheart? Let me know. I'm curious to hear your opinions on this one. Left-handed Jedi says Lionheart for the win. Fuck yes. I thought he was fantastic in that role. Oh, so amazing. Especially when I love that moment when he's doing this scene from Richard III, you know? And he's got the nose on and the limp and everything. And I did Richard III once. I did as part of a collection of vignettes, a collection of Shakespearean vignettes. And the scene I did was with Richard and Anne. And I loved doing that. I loved portraying that character, you know, getting all, I was all uglied up and I had the hunch going on. I had the limp. I got the idea to put these, I went outside and found some sharp rocks, put those rocks in my shoe. And so I had this limp and this hunch and, you know, fucked up, you know, crooked nose and everything. It was a very little makeup effects, but like this. And then, you know, of course the costuming as well, and worked across from this excellent actress named Alicia, who was amazing. And so she was a terrific Anne, and she played into my Richard so well. And I was just this beautiful moment. Loved doing that. So it was so much fun. Love the Shakespeare showcases are always a lot of fun. I personally, you know, like, you know, because this is not a theater. Macbeth is my favorite. It's my absolute favorite. Second favorite is Titus Andronicus. You know, I love that. But I love playing Macbeth. The Macbeth is my number one role. I fucking just adore that role. So as of Shakespeare plays, I think that one that's always been my favorite. Yeah, I think the one that I'm best suited for. King Lear, I dig, you know, and to Hamlet as well. But I loved the grit and the themes of Macbeth. I really do, you know. Love those ones. All right. So, but let us know down in the comments below. Better villain. Who was the better villain? Both Vincent Price. But who did it? Like, which one did he play better? Dr. Phoebes? Or Lionheart, or the actor Lionheart. Love to hear what y'all think. Let us know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com. All right. Well, that was the last one we've got to talk about tonight, so you know what time it is. It's trivia time. That's right. It is trivia time. So flex those Google fingers. Get them ready because the person who gets the answer to this one in the chat first, we'll win a special something from the Weekend Horror Store. And if you haven't seen them yet, we added two new items. We've got a camping. We have a Friday the 13th themed camping mug, or camping like coffee mug. It's like a camping cup. So it's like, you know, the steel classic one, but it's Friday the 13th themed. And we've got a Michael Myers No Lives Matters coffee mug as well. So added two new mugs for your Weekend Horror collection are available on the store right now. So I love this. I dropped those prices down as low as I could get. So I know some people that have already won some. So look for those coming soon. All right. So here we go. Your trivia question for tonight. Get ready. What was the name of the first ever alien abduction horror film? What was the name of the first ever alien abduction horror film? And just a hint, there are two names. There are two working titles for this that I will accept, one or the other. So there's two possible answers to this because both of them are correct. So if you find one, pop it in there. So once again, what was the name of the first ever alien abduction horror film? Let us know. First one in the live chat wins a special something from the Week in Horror store. Holy shit, Operation Free World got that quick. That is the McPherson tape. Absolutely, that is the name of it, the McPherson tape, otherwise known as UFO abduction. So, the closer chasm is the UFO abduction, not UFO incident, but the McPherson tape. Well done, Operation Free World. Let me get your name down. That is the last trivia question for the month of March. Can you believe it? We're already in April. But well done. Yes, Operation Free World got it with the McPherson tape, which is essentially kind of a telling of the Betty and Barney Hill story. If you're not familiar with that, you can definitely look it up. But essentially is the first majorly publicized alien abduction event was the Betty and Barney Hill story, which is why a lot of people think that because the Travis Hill incident, the Snowflake, Arizona incident, the Travis Walton incident, his story matched very similar to theirs. And that's why a lot of people think that Travis got the idea from the Betty and Barney Hill story. So, but yes, congratulations, Operation Free World. We will get that special prize for you printed up and shipped to you ASAP. Got you right here. Well done. Congratulations. All right, horror fiends. And that's going to conclude this episode of the Week in Horror podcast. Thank you all for joining us. We truly hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, smash that like and subscribe button and be sure to hit that bell so you never miss a future episode. Join us next week when we look back at the Bird horror homage, Caw, the 80s supernatural slasher Bad Dreams, the star-studded 70s Satanist horror The Mephisto Waltz, and the brooding Welsh folk horror The Dark. Be sure to check out Josh Olson's store at badsamurai.store, where he does all the awesome artwork you see splattered all over our merchandise, which you can find over at Teespring. For more from Week in Horror, check out all the bloody links that are down in the description. Follow us on the socials for the daily splatter, join our Discord for watch parties, big announcements, all kinds of horror shenanigans, and support the show through channel memberships right here on YouTube, Super Chats, PayPal, or even with our Patreon. Get your name on the banner below. For as little as a dollar a month, you can help to make this show possible. We love you if you do. Thank you so very, very much. Thank you for hanging out with us. You know, but if you can support the show, we'd really appreciate it. As always, I've been your host, JL. We will see you all next week. And like we usually say around here, stay scared.